Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down in a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're talking to Joan Gausted. Welcome, Joan, to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You and I were talking a little bit downstairs about your work, and I mentioned to you that I thought beauty and terror, somehow there's this wonderful ambiguous quality to your work around seems like those almost those two themes. Do you see that in your work?
I would like to see that in my work. I've heard sweet and dangerous and. I don't know. I have this one painting that's in the show that's at ADA right now. It's a series of five paintings on linen, and Jerry Donato, my art mate, looked at it and was smiling, and I said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Well, what is it you're hoping to achieve?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to create beauty." And he said, "Really? So what's with the teeth?" And I said, because it's a snaggletooth little child, a child mm-hmm. with a missing tooth holding a duck with a kind of expression of triumph. Well, she's coming out of a bathtub, a bubble bath. And I said, "Well, I want it to be true." And he said, "Truth and beauty?" And I said, "Well, no, I want to see the beauty in truth." So.
See the beauty in truth.
Yeah.
Like, as opposed to the truth and beauty.
Well, it's kind of like I'm taking Zen Buddhism again after 12 mm-hmm. years, and the first time it didn't really strike me as the right thing for me. It seemed a bit cold, and I leaned more towards Tibetan Buddhism. And this time I'm connecting with certain things like the whole notion of samsara, that sort of cycle of desire and frustration and heartache, is not something we get through to get to nirvana, but
right.
that samsara is nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love that. And I think in my art before, I was trying to make it the Buddhist notion of life is suffering but sacred, so I put all this little gold
right.
stuff on top of it.
Because it was very, very decorative.
It was
almost
very
decorative. Almost Tibetan, really, if you know
exactly.
much about, really, you know, similar colors.
That was on my wall.
It was one
wall.
Of the things about Tibetan Buddhism that I always kind of went, why all this, you know, sparkly stuff?
Well,
and bright colors.
On my studio wall when we were in New York, we had a studio in New York, the Tibetan sand painters were there, and I had a picture of them on the wall. And at the time, my work wasn't like that, but, you know, things get, and then I started studying Tibetan Buddhism. And it's kind of strange to think of what comes first, but you're right. I really, really decorated the work. And I always thought the artist Myron Helfgott, whenever you mention Dave Hickey, he'd always say, "Dave Hickey seems to think beauty is something you can put on top of your art." And I'd always laugh. And then I thought, that's what I'm doing.
Right.
I'm taking these images that disturb me, and I'm decorating them like a cake.
Yeah.
And after I realized that, I just stopped cold. I couldn't do that
What was that
anymore.
About?
Pardon me?
What was that about, do you think?
Well, I just, you know,
taking
I
these disturbing images and decorating them like a cake. I mean, that's an
trying,
amazing statement.
I read, I actually think I heard it on NPR, but I didn't catch who said it, that the notion that artists are just trying to make things right, you know, especially
mm-hmm.
artists that maybe have something disturbing in their lives, that it's just reordering their world by making art some kind of control. And I think I was trying to make it sacred. You know, life is suffering, but sacred, and putting all the gold on it, it didn't really change it. So I think you made the comment one show, the first show I had mm-hmm. without all of that, I heard that you said Joan's taken her armor off, and I loved that.
Yeah.
It was just true,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I did feel I remember Lester Van Winkle said the paintings were unembarrassed, and I
Lester,
thought,
who is a sculptor, taught for years at VCU,
my freshman teacher, and thought, gosh, I thought this work was really embarrassed. It seemed very raw and bare, and it was, you know, bare linen, and I've painted on formica, and you know, you were asking me before, I always, the surfaces always feel like skin to me. And I sort of go with that.
Yeah.
And now in
so what do you think you were trying to correct? if you buy that?
Well, it's funny because I
I think that's an interesting.
I don't know that we need to be so sure. I remember being at Solvent Space with you, and they had those giant pillows that were supposed to be paintings.
Well, it was one giant pillow.
Huge pillow that took up the whole room.
The entire room.
And you said, well, as a painter, what do you think? And I said, well, I don't really think of myself as a painter. And you said, well, what? And I said, sort of a storyteller without words. And you said, an illustrator. And I said, well, no, because an illustrator starts with a story and then illustrates it. Mm-hmm. I always feel like my work is telling me a story, but I still, and that's the reason this is my first sort of professional show. I always felt like I try and show in alternative spaces because I didn't want to part with anything because everything seemed like chapters in a story, and if I didn't have all of it. But I'm feeling like the work is trying to tell me what the story is. When I was trying to actually be an illustrator in New York and I took pictures to Time Magazine, one of them was of Ronald Reagan, and the editor just looked up at me and said, you seem to be saying something here, and I'm not sure what it is. And I've never forgotten that, because sometimes I'll look at my painting and say, you seem to be saying something here, and I'm not sure what it is.
Right.
And, you know, I painted babies for so long, and it was just, I don't know, I mean, in my mind, the reason I was doing it was, as near as I could figure out, the challenge of taking something so powerless and making a powerful image out of it.
Yeah.
That was sort of the challenge.
Yeah.
And,
which you did, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, well, I've always used my family as models, so my nieces started growing up, and so then I started doing the pictures.
Well, talk
of
a little bit
girls.
About the mystery of committing your life to making images that you don't know why you're making them. What is that?
Compulsion and the luck of being able to do it.
You
know, Jerry and I, we lived really simply for a really long time, just in a storefront above our studios. So we were able to just hang out, make the work we wanted to make, really make the work we wanted to make, because neither of us sold our work.
But there was no narrative, or I mean, we were talking earlier about, you know, I said, you know, well, then you mean you're an illustrator, you're telling a story, but you don't, there's no narrative. I mean, it's such an easy word to say, it means, but it means so many different things. Some subconscious, I mean, these images, I mean, you nailed it when you said a minute ago about taking something, you know, like how'd you say it, taking a baby and turning it into,
such
a powerless
image, and trying to make it powerful.
Right. Which I've known you for years, and it's interesting because that harkens back to what you said before, because I've always seen you as, on the surface, very sort of gentle and gentle. And yet I always knew that you had incredible internal strength. And maybe that's the struggle. I'm going to turn this into psychobabble, but if what you're saying is true, maybe that's the thing you're trying to resolve. This conflict between this you know, woman who grew up in many different places, but also in the South, who on the surface is very feminine, very gentle, very sensitive, very caring and thoughtful about other people. But I also know, you know, as you've been described, has a spine of steel. And I've seen that in your life. And interesting dichotomy. And I don't know if you see that in your work or not.
Well, I'd like to.
Or did I just make all that up?
I'd like to.
I'll send you a bill. Well, I think it's there. So, I think your work, I mean, I hadn't seen your work, I guess, maybe a year. I think your work has markedly changed over the last year. It seems much more open, much more fluid. you know, obviously you're not decorating anymore. The imagery is still with children, still with children in what could be innocent situations, could be terrifying situations. There's that wonderful ambiguity of it, sort of the sublime, you know, you just, mm-hmm. you're not quite sure which way to go with it. Do you think your work's changed? I mean, it's one thing for me to say it.
I do, and it was conscious. It really was conscious. Mm-hmm. Virginia Samsel, who's about to get the Emerging Artist Award for the Pollock Society, she's a young woman who really, she'd come over and show me her work, and she'd say, I really love this. And I would think, I never feel that way about my work. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I should make things that really please me, that I really take pleasure in looking at. So I
think that was... What did you feel? If you didn't feel pleasure, what did you feel? Was there a kind of repulsion? I mean, there must have been... what was the emotional reaction? I mean, I can't imagine you looked at your work and went, eh.
No, but okay. I remember when Lisa Yaskavich came here and lectured, everyone was trying to pin her down on what her work was about, and she said, well, it's really the formal issues that are the fun of it. And I thought, that is exactly true. That's what gets me through. I don't start out thinking I'm going to do it. Usually things, I mean, I'll start thinking something is, I'm going to make a humorous image, and it will go, it just goes its own way.
Right.
But it is the formal issues I really like.
Like?
Playing with space. Today, I was looking with some people, just happened to see an etching of mine from right out of school. And it seems very, very different, very delicate, veiled lady. But the whole playing with space thing is there, still there. And even though the lines are very delicate, it's still sort of the broken
line. When you say playing with space, because there are people listening who are very sophisticated and some who aren't, what do you mean?
Oh, gosh. Just you're not really sure where things are. You know, the plane, shadows, things kind of disappearing. Like I did a big, long painting, and I realized later there was just this puzzle piece laying on the floor of my studio, a white puzzle piece. And I realized later that was what it was all about. But I had a photo of myself as an adult and a photo of myself as a baby, and they happened to be overlapping. And the adult arm reached into the baby arm. But also, more to the playing with space, I wanted all the white parts just to go into the wall. It's kind of hard to describe without it in front of you. But even when I was in school, parts of the bodies would disappear. You wouldn't know what was what. Well, just in the show that I have up now on First Friday, this young punker guy was telling his friends what was going on in this piece, and I was listening over, and he said, you see, this arm comes from this weird creature behind. And he looked up at me and said, what do you think? And I said, I think that's right. And he said, are you the artist? And I said, I am. And he said, well, don't you know? And I said, well, I think I do now. I think you're right. That wasn't my intention.
Right.
But it totally, I think he was right.
Right.
And so it
seems to be so much mystery in your work to you.
Yes. And I think, actually, I was thinking about this earlier. I'm an Army brat, and my work is photo-based. And, you know, it's family. But I think this is very true of a lot of people who grow up in families that travel a lot. Your photos mean so much to you. You're always looking back into them, trying to hold on to things.
Because everything's changing.
Everything's changing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole thing with just memory. I mean, I do think my work is a lot about memory and trying to hold on to things. I mean, there's one picture of me as a baby in Louisiana, and I look at it and I can just sort of smell that Louisiana gin and tonic humid air.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the Proust thing, you know, the Madeleine. And I love the part where he says, it's not in us, it is us. I love that. I just love that. You know, the whole memory, the memory.
Well, that's part of your work, isn't it?
I think that's it.
Yeah.
I really think that's it.
Yeah, interesting. Something I wanted to ask you about with your work. Do you see sexual overtones in your work? Because when I look at it, there's sometimes there's a child a new child, and there's a hand sort of coming into the picture plane, and I can't tell if it's caressing or if it's violating. It's almost sublime. I mean, in terms of its ambiguity. How does that strike you?
I like what Sally Bowring says about the work. She says it's about touch, mm-hmm. and I really like that. But I think it's also sort of a Rorschach or a mirror. I've seen people come up to the work and say, oh, that's so sweet, and other people looking kind of horrified. And I noticed in the first Friday opening of this show, all the young people like scary things. They like Grimm's Fairy Tale. And this one man, he wasn't that old. He looked like maybe late 30s, just walked in and stopped cold and said, this is really scary. Mm-hmm. So those that you're talking about, I think some of those early ones, they did feel threatening to me. They definitely felt mm-hmm. threatening. But I sort of made a conscious effort to take it to a different place, and the five paintings of the little girl in the bathtub.
Are these the ones in the show now?
The ones in the show now.
Okay, where is this show again?
It's at ADA Gallery, mm-hmm. which is, I think...
It's on Broad Street.
Broad Street near 1708. It's 228.
And when is it open, do you know?
Well, there's a reception where I'm going to speak a little bit casually on the 16th, and that's from 6 to 8. 16th of October,
right.
And the next day, Friday, it will be open from 7 to 10.
Right, and we're talking here with Joan Gausted, who I've known for, well, at least a couple of years anyway. who is a wonderful, wonderful artist. You said earlier that you hadn't sold your work, but that in no way is any measure of the work. The work is fascinating and ambiguous and beautiful and terrifying all at the same time. Why you made reference to this a little bit, but why do you use raw tan linen in your canvas? I think you were mentioning skin when we were talking earlier.
Right. I worked for many years just on paper, and I just wanted to be a drawer, which wasn't really much done at the time, but now it is. And I loved the... I would sort of use the paper. I would think of it almost as skin. Well, the linen...
But why skin? I mean... Maybe you should have been a tattoo artist.
That's, some of those things do look like tattoos.
But that's interesting to say, the skin. What's the, don't know?
Well, and now the Mylar has this real, I was looking at the Mylar drawings, and there was the young woman, Rachel, who works at the gallery, had that incredible translucent skin. I kept mm-hmm. looking at the Mylar and mm-hmm. looking at her. Well, I don't know why. Just, things that draw us, things that...
Well, okay, so the tan linen, but you're also are using other materials.
Pink formica.
Layered imagery, mylar, pink formica, what else?
Well, in this show, something that I really had fun with, for my paintings, I'll do drawings on clear acetate and then project them, because I really like things mm-hmm. to be played right to the edge, and that way I can get it just where I want it. But I started really liking the sketches. They were so loose. I wasn't thinking I was making art. So I started photocopying them and just, pinning them up like posters. I also wanted to just make art that I could just sell really cheaply, mm-hmm. Just get it out in the world. But then I really wanted to just show the clear copies. The wonderful things just happened.
Yeah.
And so... In this show...
Were you drawing with grease pencil, or what were you doing?
No, these mm-hmm. German Staedtler markers. And the problem was, I wanted to put them in the show, but we weren't sure that the markers weren't fugitive, like that the ink might just totally disappear. So I had clear copies made that mm-hmm. are archival. And that's when the fun began, because I started layering them.
Right.
Separating them and putting them away from the wall a bit, so making it more ambiguous, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. just trying to see what's going on behind. Some are more so than others.
Mm-hmm. So literally laying the sheets of plastic
on top of each other.
Okay, all right.
And
with different images on each
different
sheet.
Different images.
Okay. Right.
And so I just really enjoyed doing that and having something kind of looser and more accessible, because... if I am going to start, well, I feel really ready to let the work go out in the world. It's like Sally says, those little soldiers want to march. I love that when she said that. And I thought, well, it's okay. It's just sort of like sending your kids to college. You can have a family reunion and they can all come back someday for some little retrospective or something.
But selling of it and that kind of recognition has never been terribly appealing to you or interesting to you.
Always felt like, I remember saying to Myron one time, and I thought he was going to really be appalled by this, but I said, I feel like my work is communicating with my friends in a way I can't otherwise. And the last thing I willingly sold was in 1988, 20 years ago, and I was shocked that anybody bought it. And I couldn't grasp that it wasn't mine.
Right.
It's like, I made this. How can it be yours?
Right.
And I even gave the woman prints to let me take it with me to New York. And it's not because it was such a great painting, but I needed it. And so it's been kind of like that.
Sort of like the Indians not being able to understand how Americans could buy land.
Oh, right.
What do you mean you're going to buy the land?
Right.
The land
belongs
to all of us. How are you going to buy the land?
That's exactly it. And then I also remember Camille Paglia saying, once an artist parts with a work, it's not theirs to say what it is anymore. And that kind of horrified me. Although I wasn't really saying what it was, I didn't really want anyone else saying it either. So,
but you're okay with that guy coming up to your work and saying that arm coming out of that? You're okay with that?
Yeah. Well, I actually think he was right.
Yeah, because I mean, I think one of the things about about art, if it's going to be, this is a tricky word, but if it's going to be, if it's going to be accepted, unlike most people think, it has to be within certain cultural bounds so that people can identify with it and see what they want to see or not see what they don't want to see. But if it's too far outside of the culture, then, you know, you see artists who, you know, maybe spend 100 years before their work is recognized as being valid, or you see them get very bitter and very rejected and you know. And the artists of today, unlike I think a lot of there's a lot of assumption that somehow art is made outside of the culture, but I think the fact that people walk in and see your work and have different responses means that it is within the culture, but it's also good enough so that people can relate to it in very, very different ways, which is very interesting. You know, that you're not making work and people are walking and going, I don't get it. What's that? You know, and I think there are some poor artists out there who think, "Yay, they don't get it." Well, yay, guess what? You're never going to go anywhere, and nobody's ever going to look at your work. So anyway, how do you find the time and the energy to make work? You know, I mean, life is difficult and challenging, and you know, more so in sometimes than others. How do you do that?
Well, it's different now. It used to be, for me and Jerry, it was what our lives were all about. I mean, if we went to the beach, we'd take a whole room of the cabin. And now, I never used to be the kind of person who wanted to work for a show, but I sort of make responsibilities. You know, I just say, I commit to things, and then I have to do it.
Right.
So, and also, I used to work incredibly slowly. My paintings would take years, really years. And now I don't have that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. It looks like, is your work much faster now?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
How's that?
Well, the Pink Formica pieces that I had in the Plant Zero show, it just, I think part of it is I really did start to feel like I wanted my work to get out in the world, and it would maybe be easier to part with things if I didn't invest so much of my life in them. But those just, it was funny, the small ones took a long time, but the big ones, it just, those pieces to me, they were, I know a lot of artists will say this, sometimes things just happen, they're just gifts. You just stand back and think, wow, where did that come from? And I don't know, it just happens. Sometimes things just happen.
And so when you're making work, does time just sort of disappear sometimes?
Is it, yes.
Yes.
Definitely go into the sort of dream state. But, you know, something, Carolyn Henney gave a great talk at ADA once about her work, and then at a certain point she said, and now we get to the part where what's in it for the viewer? And I just stood there and thought, whoa, I don't think I've gotten to that part. And that's why I think before, I love Richard Roth's model. I forced a bunch of people once to talk about whether they considered the viewer when they were working. Mm-hmm. And the sculptors and performance artists said, of course you have to, and that makes sense. And the painters said no. And Richard, I love what he said. He said he liked the model of the scientist, where you work away, and when you get the discovery mm-hmm. that you think, wow, this is it, mm-hmm. you take it out and say to other people, is this, you know, this, I see this. What do you see?
What do you see?
And I think that was the way I worked before, but when I had to do these pieces recently, I did feel a sense of responsibility to the people who asked me to show. And so I felt like maybe I was taking less risk. And I really like risk in work. Mm-hmm. I really like things mm-hmm. that, well, those pink formica things, I would draw them.
When you say pink formica, describe that to me.
Well, they were just these big sheets of this really kind of horrible mm-hmm. color of pink and that I got at Lowe's that they were getting rid of because nobody wanted this hideous pink kitchen, but it looked like skin. It was about
skin,
you know, close to the color of the pinky person. But I would draw. I drew my niece's face, and the expression was so right on, this kind of, mm-hmm. you know, really poignant, but looking you right in the eyes. And suddenly I felt compelled to take a water sprayer and just spray it. And I thought, why?
Mm.
But I had no obligation. You know, nobody was waiting to see this work, so I just did it. And it ended up being so the right thing because her big teddy bear was sort of reaching for her with his paw. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like it just kind of gave this motion to the painting. And it really did feel like a gift. And another piece that I was doing, I just spent an afternoon and Jerry was sick and I had to get home and I ran home. And the next day I came back and it just was saying what I wanted it to say, but I thought, don't be ungenerous. You could do something more to the eyes. And I really just actually heard this voice. I mean, but Stephen King says he hears voices. So I thought, well, I hear voices too. I'm going to start listening to him.
Right.
And I heard this voice just say, leave it alone. And I was actually just felt compelled to do a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. don't be ungenerous. But then I thought, no, it says what it needs to say.
Yeah.
So I'm sure this is way off from whatever you asked.
No. I think it says what it needed to say is a wonderful way to end, actually, if you can believe it. We're out of time.
Perfect.
Well, thank you, Joan, for taking
time to
talk with us. All right. Well, thank you, folks, for listening. We hope to see you on the radio again next Friday at 12:30. And this is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.